Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 8th, 1999. In the fireside room this morning is Barbara Rossing. Today's session is number 99-4 and is titled Revelation, Imperial Critique and the Where of Babylon. Let's listen in.
Welcome again, everybody. I know some of you are new. Obviously, some have had to leave during the week, and you can jump in at any point in Holden. My name is Barbara Rossing, and this is the fourth now in a series on the Book of Revelation. Most of you have been here at least once, right? Just to remind you, I'm giving you actually this week what is a fairly widely accepted scholarly interpretation of Revelation, but it's very different probably from what you're hearing on the radio or the TV, because we're so ingrained with a literalist approach to the Book of Revelation, which is one approach to Revelation. It's a legitimate one. It was made popular, especially in the 19th century, with a thing that was called the Scofield Reference Bible that became the main Bible used by people on the prairies. If you want to learn more about this, I'm highly recommending this book, When Time Shall Be No More. You're reading it, huh? Yeah. Very helpful with this whole... Oh, okay, good. It's supposed to be on reserve. Good, okay.
Yeah, if anybody wants.
Okay. Yeah, and we ordered it for the bookstore, but it's by a historian named Paul Boyer, and it talks about the history of sort of prophecy belief that is fundamentalist prophecy belief in American culture. Really interesting. And I'll show you some more stuff from this today. But anyway, so I am not taking a literalist approach to the Book of Revelation. We're rather interpreting some of the images metaphorically, looking at it in the context of the genre, the literary genre of apocalypse, and what that means. Yesterday, we started into this difficult middle section. We went up into the throne room, saw the vision of God, which is so typical of an apocalypse. You always have this journey theme, or generally have, where someone goes on a journey, sees visions of the heavens or the underworld, the future or the past, and then brings back a message to their community. That's what John is doing here. And then we saw the start of the opening of the seals. And I suggested three strategies that'll help you get through the middle section. First, to keep on reading. Don't get bogged down. Don't stop. Don't try to figure out each image. Just let the ensemble work its power on you. Second, read it all in terms of the Exodus story, because I think that's a very central template that's used to structure the Book of Revelation, as well as this idea of calling us from an Exodus out of Roman imperial domination into God's new Jerusalem. And tomorrow we're going to really talk about what does that mean for us today then. Rome is gone. What have we got? And what, if anything, does it say to us? And then the third strategy was to read for these salvation interludes between the sixth and the seventh element in these sequences. You've got salvation in between. Okay, we're going to race on through the middle section today. I want to talk about the imperial critique of Rome that we see, especially in chapters 13 and 17 and 18, and then get to the millennium at the end. So we're going to cover a lot. All right, I've plotted out Revelation. So far, I'm sorry my handwriting is so bad here. In terms of these layers that you've got going on through the Book of Revelation, parallel layers. In the first three chapters, it all takes place on Earth. That's the setup where we learn about the historical situation. Then in chapter 4, we went up into heaven, and in 4 and 5, we've got the throne room vision there. And then from that point on, heaven and Earth are sort of counter levels, with heaven breaking into singing, giving a commentary on Earth, the heavenly chorus to sort of tell us what the real world behind the curtain is, what God's real world is. And then we have this other layer of the underworld or the abyss. An important thing happens in chapter 12, and we're going to look at that. The trumpets and the seals take place before chapter 12, and the bowls are after chapter 12, beginning in chapter 15 and 16. In chapter 12, a very interesting chapter, right at the center of the book, we meet this mythic, interesting woman figure, the woman clothed with the sun, if you want to take a look at that. And what happens, the important plot development is that Satan is going to get thrown out of heaven. Apparently, Satan and his whole retinue of evil powers up until this point were in heaven. And in chapter 12, he gets thrown down to earth and is really mad about it. ultimately in chapter 20, he's going to get tied up and cast all the way down into the abyss. But in these intervening chapters here, between chapter 12 and chapter 20, things get worse before they get better, because now Satan is stalking on earth, and he's mad. And that, I think, is part of why the bowls are so much worse than the trumpets. Everything is intensified once Satan is thrown out of heaven and before he's cast down into the abyss. All right, so that's the middle of the book. Let's just take a look briefly at chapter 12, a really interesting chapter here. Let's see, would someone like to read? How about verses 1 through 1 through 6.
A great portent appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. She was pregnant and was crying out in birth pains in the agony of giving birth. Then another portent appeared in heaven, a great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 diadems on his head. On his heads. His tail swept down a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. Then the dragon stood before the woman who was about to bear a child, so that he might devour her child as soon as it was born. And she gave birth to a son, a male child, who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. But her child was snatched away and taken to God and to his throne. And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God, so that there she can be nourished for 1,260 days.
Okay. So a woman gives birth to a child, a male child. Where have you heard this story before? Who is this woman? I mean, that's a really important question. Great debate here as well. And interpretations have varied. I don't think she is just one thing. I think, like many of the images of Revelation, she's multivalent, has several dimensions to her. This is one of the most sort of mythic chapters of Revelation. And I don't mean mythic in a sense of meaning, you know, like, it's just a myth, it's false, or it's not true. Myths are very true for us. Myths are really an important way of structuring our imagination. And I wanted to read just a little quote here from Pablo Richard, where he sort of says that, because how he's really helped me, I mean, I never know why people write poetry when they could write prose. I don't know why they write myths when they could just write straight talk either. You know, I guess this is our sort of scientific worldview. And I read these Latin American novels, you know, like Isabel Allende. And when they start into that kind of fantastic dimension, you know, it's like, why not just stay in regular time and regular things? Did anybody see that movie, like Water for Chocolate, a few years ago? You know, where just when you think you know what's going on, then all of a sudden the outhouse starts on fire for no apparent reason. You know, strange things are always happening, and the magic, there's magic in these.
That genre is called magical realism.
Magical realism?
Right.
Okay.
Where you have supposedly sort of a realistic world, but then all of a sudden these fantastic elements start popping into them without disrupting the sort of normal temporal frame of the novel. Like somebody can fall out of an airplane and just land on earth and start walking uninjured, and that would be considered somehow normal.
Sounds like Wile E. Coyote and
okay.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, anyway, this is an important element. I mean, I think there's a difference, because that would be magic. In Apocalypse, it's God's power. I mean, it's the dueling powers that are sort of going on, and it's very important. Pablo Richard talks about how important for marginalized people it is to recover a sense of the mythic dimension of life, a sense of imagination, of Christian imagination, that part of faith is about being able to envision a different world. And it's not imagination in the sense of fiction, it's rather imagination in being able to see yourself as a child of God, as a citizen of a different world, even when things around here are doing everything they can to take away your power of vision to see things differently. He writes, Revelation provides visions of an alternative world to give heart to Christians and increase their ability to resist. Like poetry, a vision seeks to organize the people's imaginative experience. Its function is that of creative imagination. Apocalyptic literature creates visions to help the people imagine and create a different world that is an alternative to the world that is no more, or to the oppressing, dominating world. It is especially through myths and visions that apocalyptic serves to keep memory alive. People recall their past and see their future in terms of God's visions for their future. I mean, it's pictures, and that's what apocalyptic is about, he says, is rebuilding people's power to envision a different scenario, a different way of life. Well, that's sort of what you've got going on here in Revelation 12. I mean, it's obviously visionary. It's obviously mythic. Some scholars say, you know, these 12 stars, it's possible allusion to the zodiac, which was so popular in Greco-Roman culture. There's all kinds of things going on. There were Greco-Roman myths that had a sort of story much like this, with the goddess Leto giving birth to her child Apollo, and then the dragon tried to eat it. It was common also in Egyptian myth, the goddess Isis giving birth to her son Horus, and then the dragon Python trying to eat this child. So maybe it's appealing to what's familiar to people and yet setting it in a Christian context now. And it's a very Christian vision. There are huge differences from how it's told in Greco-Roman myths. But anyway, this is an interesting chapter here. The traditional Roman Catholic interpretation was that the woman was Mary giving birth to her child Jesus. That's one possibility. You also can read the woman as Israel, we heard that at the first session, or as the church. And that's how Martin Luther interpreted her. And he, in fact, wrote a love song to her called She's My Fair, Dear, Worthy Maid. And he sings about her. It's an interesting song. But anyway, Revelation 12 is a kind of turning point in the book, because Satan, we'll see that in verse 9 here. The woman flees to the wilderness. She's got a place prepared for her. Then war arises in heaven. In verse 7, Michael and all his angels fighting against the dragon.
Barbara?
Uh-huh?
I just had a question about the very specific number of days.
Okay.
Is there any significance that it's 1,260 days?
Well, not to me, but you can read books like this. Well, I mean, listen to the radio.
That's what I'm asking. Is there any thoughts about it? Or does somebody have, say, well, this is what it could mean? I'm just wondering.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk about what that might mean. It's like 3 years, isn't it, or 2.5 years or something? I should look it up. Richard would know, or Schistler Fiorenzo. Actually, why don't I give you one of these and just look it up? They'll both tell you. Because I don't take a very literalist approach to the book, I don't pay much attention to those specific numbers, and that's the weak point of my interpretation. I know I've read it a million times, and I just can't remember, but just look up anywhere Revelation 12, verse 6, and they'll tell you what scholars think about those numbers. I don't think the numbers are to be read literally. That's the important thing. Okay, so Satan gets thrown down, and now is stalking the earth. And at the end of the chapter, you see, then the dragon was angry with the woman. This is verse 17. It went off to make war on the rest of her offspring, on those who keep the commandments of God and bear testimony to Jesus. So that's us. That's the signal, sort of, that things are about to get worse, because the dragon's really mad, and he's going to take it out on the people on earth. And that's the setup then for chapter 13, which I've mentioned a couple times this week. Chapter 13 of the book of Revelation is about the most anti-government chapter you can find in the whole Bible. Contrast that to Romans 13, for example, where Paul says, obey government. Government is ordained by God. Revelation 13 portrays government as two beasts. The first rising out of the sea, and we think this is probably the emperor himself in Rome, possibly anyway. And the second beast seems to be the provincial powers in Asia Minor. This is the beast rising from the land here. And it's a very, very critical portrait of the Roman Empire in terms of these two great beasts that are like dragons with the multi-heads and horns and everything. The second beast, let's take a look at that, because this is what people were then actually experiencing. In verse 12 of chapter 13, it exercises all the authority of the first beast. It makes the earth and its inhabitants pay allegiance to the first beast or worship the first beast. We talked yesterday about how paying allegiance and worshiping are the same word in Greek, proskuneisis. It works great signs, even making fire come down from heaven. And we know from archaeological evidence this was true. People could do these kind of pyrotechnic things with statues, you know, that make the statues do scary things, like in The Wizard of Oz, you know, where I am Oz, the great and terrible. Someone could go up inside a statue of the Roman emperor and make it sound as if the statue was actually speaking, or make smoke come out. And you see that, let's see, in verse 14, by the science which is allowed to work in the presence of the beast, it deceives those who dwell on earth, bidding them to make an image or an icon for the beast, the statue of the emperor. And it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast so that the image of the beast should even speak. You know, the talking statue, very scary for people. And it causes all, both great and small, rich and poor, both slave and free, to be marked on the right hand or the forehead, so that no one can buy and sell without the mark of the beast. Apparently, for Christians not to participate in the Roman imperial system meant marginalization economically. And we talked about that when we looked at the seven letters, this fact that you would certainly have to be a vegetarian if you weren't going to buy the meat that had been sacrificed to the pagan gods in the meat markets. That was your only option. If you're not willing to handle the Roman coins that have the image of the emperor on them, which is probably what's being talked about here, then you surely are not able to buy and sell anything, because it was a market economy and they did have money. But you would have to use the image of the emperor. That's most likely what's going on here, although we don't know. Christians are supposed to see ourselves as marked already with the cross of Christ and sealed already by our baptism. So we have a different mark on our forehead or on our hand, which is not the mark of the beast. I mean, you've got sort of the dueling marks and dueling allegiances, dueling citizenships going on here in Revelation 13. And it's very much an either or. You cannot participate in Rome and also be a Christian, basically, John is saying here. And then finally, of course, at the end of this chapter comes the famous number from the book of Revelation. No one can buy and sell unless they have the mark of the beast, that is the number of its name. This calls for wisdom. Let the one with understanding reckon the number of the beast. It's a human number. Its number is 666. And you've seen this number before. All right, I'm going to attempt to show you some overheads now. We'll see how I do. You all know this kind of stuff, but I'll just refresh it in your mind if you haven't seen this stuff lately. This was an ad that was in a lot of major newspapers in 1992. Are you ready for the rapture? Human history will end. Supposedly, the rapture was going to come October 28th, 1992. Then this is a pre-tribulation rapture premillennialist perspective. one of the many. That fundamentalists will tell you. So then it would be the idea that there would be a rapture, then there would be the 7-year period of tribulation between 1992 and 1999, then human history will end, the 1,000-year millennium reign would begin. This is a classic sort of chronology here. But notice here, the 666 system is here.
Yeah.
And what is it?
The barcode.
It's the barcode, clearly, yes, obviously. It's definitely the mark of the beast, without which no one can buy or sell. It's very interesting. A woman named Mary Ralph, here, I'll just read you about her from this book here. Mary Stuart Ralph, then just as the barcode was coming out, she came out with, actually she's got two books now. She herself has made a lot of money, although I don't think she ever had to put the universal product code on her books. No prophecy writer has devoted more attention to these matters than Mary Stuart Ralph, a wealthy Montgomery, Alabama widow and real estate developer whose book, When Your Money Fails, The 666 System Is Here, published in 1981, sold over 600,000 copies, arguing basically that this whole system of the of having to put universal product codes on things is the mark of the beast. Then she has a second book out, too. I forget what the name of that one is, but... she calls it, let's see, Ralph found the conspiracy shockingly widespread. Beyond the UPC, the Universal Product Code, lay the banking industry, the credit card companies, the computer manufacturers, the scientists, politicians, everyone who says there's a new international economic order. Refuse credit cards, she advised, pay with cash or checks as long as possible. All the same, however, even though she didn't have to put this on her books, all the same, however, her advertisements for her books, including a Christian diet book called trim for him. welcomed MasterCard and Visa orders. So anyway, part of how she made her money was she was willing herself to accept credit card orders for books. But anyway, I mean, this stuff is everywhere in our culture. Okay, what is 666? Interestingly, I mean, I would say it's clear in Revelation 13 that there is an economic dimension to it. And I think that we need to think about that today. Maybe not in terms of this sort of literalist, you know, conspiracy theory stuff. But the economic aspects of participation in Rome are singled out to a striking degree in the book of Revelation. And we'll see that in chapter 17 also. Any comments on this kind of stuff? Have you seen things like this? Anyone ever seen anything like this? All right, let's take a look at chapter 17. This is the other place that we see Rome critique. In chapter 13, it's these two beasts, the one from the sea and the one from the land. In chapter 17, there's a different image of Rome, probably the most famous image of Rome, if not the 666. Oh, and afterwards, if any of you want, whoa, I only have a few copies. You'll have to share these. I have some funny things about 666. 666, the number of the beast. 667, the neighbor of the beast. let's see. $665.95, the retail price of the beast. And they get the Walmart price. Phillips 666, the gasoline of the beast. Route 666, the way of the beast. 666i is the BMW of the beast. Anyway, I mean, you kind of know this stuff with all these 666. An article here about how a Catholic school worked for many years to get its telephone number changed off of 666. Let me just say one more thing about it, though. Sorry, flip back to the end of chapter 13. At the end of the verse there where the 666 is mentioned, you should have a footnote. Do you? See how it says this is a human number, it calls for wisdom. Its number is 666. Then you should have some kind of footnote. And read that footnote.
616.
Yeah. Other ancient authorities read 616 or 616. This is kind of funny, you know, because much is made of the number 666, but in fact, the manuscripts don't agree. Some of the manuscripts for the book of Revelation have the number being 616, and others have 666.
Why have a number? What's the significance in John?
Well, most likely in Greek, there aren't numbers. You use letters for numbers, and you can lay this one out. Probably, this is the most likely, is to spell Nero, Kaiser, Caesar, so that it was a sort of a code for the Emperor Nero, who is dead. But there was this myth that Nero would return. He was a terrible emperor. Everybody hated him, and there was this sort of fearful. Well, it was mentioned even in the Cleopatra miniseries that none of you watched, apparently. Did really nobody watch that? Okay, well, you tried? Okay. Well, anyway, even there, you saw this idea that the Emperor Nero was somehow not really dead, but he was going to come back, and that seems, he was the worst possible emperor, so that is seems to be what his name, what is possibly what's meant here.
So it's representative government, which is, yeah. He's anti.
Uh-huh. Another possibility is that since 7 is the number of perfection, 6 means falling short of perfection, 6 is bad, so it could be like imperfect, imperfect, imperfect. We don't really know. I mean, you'll hear on the radio all kinds of things about it. So if you really want to know what these numbers mean, ask a fundamentalist and they'll tell you. It's typical of apocalypses to use numbers and colors and animals to symbolize things. But yeah, I would say here it's clearly a political symbol for the Roman government. Although you can make it mean anything you want. That's the nice thing about the images of Revelation. Whoever you love to hate, you can make it work out. I think I've got with me actually the article from Science Magazine a few years back that showed you how to do it, how to plug in anybody's name and make it be 666 through a series of steps. Yeah, it was an interesting one. And I saw a thing on the internet, I don't know if some of you have seen it, where even Barney is 666. You start by writing something like Great Purple Dragon, and then you change the U's to the Roman letter V, and then you do certain things. I mean, you only have to do a couple steps with anybody's name to get them to be 666. It's pretty easy, actually. So, yeah, you can do it.
What's the point?
Yeah, what's the point? Well, there you are. Much ink has been spilled about this, and many...
dollars made.
Yeah, many dollars made. All right, let's look at the other image of Rome now in chapter 17. Well, you know this image of Rome, and here it is. Oh. The most famous image from the book of Revelation, if not 666.
Oh,
jeez. Here she is. Yeah. The Whore of Babylon. She's appearing on the same beast from chapter 13. You're to see a link between chapter 13 and chapter 17, because in chapter 13, Rome itself was portrayed as the beast, the multi-headed beast, and now here the woman is riding on the beast. Would someone read chapter 17, verses 1 through 6? And you've got her description here.
Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, "Come, I'll show you the judgment of the great whore who is seated on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and with the wine of whose fornication the inhabitants of the earth have become drunk." So he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names, and it had seven heads and seven horns. The woman was clothed in purple and scarlet, adorned with gold and jewels and pearls, holding in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the impurities of her fornication. And on her forehead was written a name, a mystery: Babylon the Great, mother of whores and of earth's abominations. And I saw that the woman was drunk with the blood of the saints and the blood of the witnesses to Jesus.
Okay, thank you. So her description here is in this image, or I've got one. This is a more interesting one. When Martin Luther first translated the Bible from Latin into German, he had his friend Lucas Cranach, a wonderful artist, illustrate each book of the Bible with an image. And when he got to Revelation, he had him do each chapter of the Bible. So I've got transparencies from the chapters of Revelation here. And this is the image here from chapter 17. They're wonderful woodcuts, actually. They're sort of like Dürer woodcuts. Cranach was influenced by Dürer. But here she is. You can see the classic description. She's riding on this multi-headed beast. Yeah, whereas this one was sort of sitting on this beast on the floor, kind of. This is more typical. Riding side saddle, of course, because that's how they did in Martin Luther's time. But anyway, multi-heads and horns. She's got her red dress on. You've got a picture of this bright red with her purple. The jewels, the pearls. She's holding in her hand here the cup of abominations and fornications. Interestingly, Martin Luther had her wearing the papal tiara. That would have been instantly recognized by anyone as the papal tiara. He has other chapters where the beast itself is wearing the papal tiara. I wonder if I've got one of those. I don't think I brought those. But anyway, in later editions, then he took this off. This was considered too inflammatory, and he just had her wearing a crown like that. But so he's clearly identifying Babylon with Rome, or with the papacy in Rome. It's pretty transparent. I mean, if you read on chapter 17, you'll see that Babylon is seated on the seven heads are the seven hills of Rome. I mean, it's pretty clearly identified as Rome itself. Here portrayed, then, not as the beast only, although the beast is part of the picture, but as a seductress. And I think what's going on here is that Rome, in chapter 13, you're just showing the out-and-out danger of Rome. But in chapter 17, what happens when you personify Rome as a seductress, I think, is that it's getting at this aspect of a culture, of an empire, of a whole system that is attractive to people, even though it's dangerous. That's what John wants to say. There appear to be probably, I mean, we saw in the letters that there are some Christians that want to accommodate themselves to Rome. It appears that Rome was indeed attractive to people. And you know that from our culture. I mean, in Jack Nelson Pallmeyer's sermon last night, you know, the mall is attractive to us. There's much about culture that sort of sucks us in and seduces us. That's what's going on here with this portrait, I think, the seductive aspects of Rome.
Well, how difficult it must have been for people to not eat meat. I mean, just logistically to get enough food to feed your family or something without protein, an instant protein source.
Yeah. Well, and it's always the dilemma, how much to participate or not. You know, and what looks like seduction to someone is just going to be saying to another person, you know, I have to, you know, this is the world in which I was born. I've got to live in this world. And that was the dilemma for Christians in John's time. John is an extremist. I think we really need his voice today also. And I think this portrait of seduction maybe speaks even more to us. How is it, you know, obviously not very many people see our government or our culture as a hideous beast that is forcing us to do things against our will. Rather, if anything, our culture is luring us into more and more. That whole quote Jack read last night about how, you know, the capitalist system, you accumulate, you use advertising to make us have sort of endless desires that can never be sated, and we've always got to buy more stuff. I mean, we're being seduced in a lot of ways. And I think this is a very apt portrait of Rome, not just as the hideous beast, but as a seductress who in some ways is attractive to people. Part of why he did it, and I've got a few more transparencies I want to show you here. In the Greek language, and I guess I'm dwelling on this because this is what I really specialize in, is what do we do about the gendered aspects of the portrait of Rome in the Book of Revelation? What are the sort of pluses and minuses in portraying Rome as a woman? Mm-hmm. You know, and what does it do to our then characterizations of women? What do you do as a feminist if you want to avoid kind of stereotype and violent aspects of this portrait, but is there anything positive about it? And I've really struggled with what else could you have done in terms of a personification to get this seductive aspect in, but not in a gendered way, or maybe a box of chocolates or something, something that we can't resist, but is nonetheless bad for us, because that's what he's using with this figure. It worked so well because in Greek, cities were feminine. The Greek word for city is polis. You know, so like Minneapolis or metropolis. Polis is feminine. So if you personify a polis, you're going to make it a feminine figure. And indeed, this is widely known in the Greco-Roman world. This is the city of Antioch, portrayed as a woman. Everyone knew these sculptures. Every city had them. Generally, what they would do is the headdress then on the woman would be the mural crown of the city walls. And people loved their city personifications or city TK figures. She was viewed as a beloved protectress who kept the city safe. In the Hebrew Bible, also in the Old Testament, the word for city is feminine. So it's the Hebrew word ir. So when Jerusalem or Samaria or other cities were personified, as poets often do, as the prophets did, they would personify the cities as women. That was a natural. Whereas a river, the Greek word for river, potamos, is masculine. So if you personified a river, it would be a man. And indeed, every city had its sculpture of its river personified also as a masculine figure. Here is Ephesus itself. Now, I apologize, this transparency doesn't look very attractive, but indeed, the statue is beautiful. The goddess Artemis, who was the patron goddess of the city of Ephesus, and this is a statue of her with the city walls, again, as her mural crown. So every citizen of the emperor, everyone born in this time would know that you personify cities as a feminine figure, and that's just the way it is. So it's no surprise to personify Rome as a woman. What's shocking, though, is to call her a seductress. I mean, everyone would have known the portrait of Rome as a feminine figure, but to critique her or critique Rome by personifying her as this hideous seductress, that would have been shocking and very daring in John's time to use this image.
Who did you say carved
the... Oh, a guy named Lucas Cranach. I've got some more. I think I have chapter 12. Yeah, if you've been to Wittenberg in Germany, you've seen his stuff. Here's the woman clothed with the sun. I don't like this one as well. But here she is with the 12 stars on her head. And then the dragon is trying to snatch up her child with this river that's pouring out of its mouth, but the dragon is being kicked out of heaven. I've got a few others here. Well, I'll show you some more. Anyway, yeah, they're wonderful woodcuts. At the end of chapter 17, he makes the shift from a woman to a city. In fact, I think he does it long before that. The minute he names it as Babylon, I think it's already portrayed as a city. But anyway, at the end of chapter 17, he explicitly says, "The woman that you saw is the great city, which has dominion over the kings of the earth." Well, that's basically saying the woman you saw is Rome. because everyone knows what the great city is that has dominion over the kings of the earth. And from that moment on, then chapter 18 is a critique of Rome, not so much as this personified feminine figure as this city. And chapter 18, by all accounts, classical scholars and New Testament scholars alike agree, chapter 18 is one of the most daring and hard-hitting critiques of Rome that was ever written during the Roman, the time of the Roman Empire. John does not like Rome. It's very clear in chapter 18. So how he portrays his critique of Rome beautifully, poetically, is ingenious. He's drawing on Old Testament critiques of Babylon, Old Testament critiques of the ancient empire Tyre, which was on the Phoenician coast, which was such a dominating power. And so he's using Ezekiel 26 and 27. He's using Jeremiah 51 and 52. And he casts it as this kind of lament. It's like a lament in advance over someone who's not yet dead, but he's basically foretelling or proclaiming the death of Babylon using the form of a funeral dirge or funeral lament, and through that form doing some very hard-hitting political and economic critique of Rome, and calling us out of it. You look at chapter 18, verse 4. Then I heard another voice from heaven saying, "Come out of it, my people," or "come out of her," "come out of Babylon, my people, lest you participate in its sins, lest you share in its plagues." So that's the call to all of us, is to come out of Babylon, because Babylon is going to fall, and don't be part of that when it's going down. That's basically what he's saying. Cronach's version of Revelation 18 looks like this. Fortunately, he shifts from a woman to a city when he moves from 17 to 18, because otherwise what you have is the, I've got a picture of what happens if you, well, I don't know where it is. Anyway, if you showed the woman being burned and tortured, that would be a really misogynist kind of image. But fortunately, he's shifting now to buildings going up in flames, the shift from a woman to a city. Here's the groups. We're going to see the three groups in the center of chapter 18 who stand on the shore, who weep and mourn over their great city. It's the kings, the merchants, and the mariners. Not the baseball team, but the seafarers, or those who are part of the shipping industry. They all stand on shore. They weep and wail as their city goes up in flames. The angel drops from heaven a great millstone and throws it into the sea. Is kind of emblematic of the end of Rome's domination. And so Rome hasn't fallen yet when John is writing. He's writing a lament in advance that is very, very powerful. Verse 9, you see, this is the lament of the kings here. The kings of the earth who committed fornication and lived luxuriously will weep and wail over it, when they see the smoke of Babylon's burning, and they'll stand afar off in torment and say, "Alas, alas," or "Woe, woe, thou great city, thou mighty city, Babylon, in 1 hour thy judgment has come." Then the central and longest lament is that of the merchants. No coincidence here. I think John is very much interested in economic critique of Rome. The merchants of the earth will weep and mourn for Babylon, for no one buys their cargo anymore. And then comes this long list in verses 12 and 13, this long cargo list that we've tended to skip over, but I want to do some more with it next week when I talk about the Bible and ecology, because you look at the items here in this list, it's logs. It's all the produce of Rome's conquered lands that are now being shipped off to Rome and to the great cities. I mean, it's basically what happens in our world today with globalization, where the natural resources, you know, Philippines used to be, 90% forested, and now it's mostly chopped down, is where the resources of these lands are taken off to feed the global economy. No one buys their cargo anymore, cargo of gold, silver, jewels, and pearls. This is the literary link between the whore of Babylon, who's wearing this jewelry now in the city. I mean, he keeps bringing in the same things. But then he goes on and on. Fine linen, purple, silk, scarlet, all kinds of scented wood. These are woods from North Africa. Articles of ivory. During Rome, the population of elephants was practically decimated. The number of animals that they took for entertainment. So, I think he's critiquing this kind of consumption here. All articles of costly wood, bronze, iron, marble, I mean, everything. The list goes on and on. Look at the end of 13. Horses and chariots, that's military. And slaves, that is human souls. This is the only author who really is willing in the Bible to do this kind of critique of the slave trade. 20% of the population of the Roman Empire was slaves, we think, maybe higher in some cities. Everyone knew about the slave economy. That's what was the backbone of this system. And John is critiquing even this. The merchants are going to weep and wail because no one's buying their cargo, and it includes slaves. This is a really important chapter in the history of the opposition to slavery in our country, because where the Apostle Paul seems to have even possibly sent back a runaway slave, Philemon, in the book of Philemon with Onesimus there, and whereas in the Gospels we see Jesus using slaves in illustrations about the kingdom of God even, here in Revelation 18 there's an out-and-out critique of the slave trade and the slave economy. This is a really important chapter. All right, then the third lament is that of the mariners. They're all standing there weeping and wailing because Rome is going to fall. So the call to us is to come out of Babylon. I mean, to come out of Rome, to escape before we're sucked into participating in this. And I really want to talk, especially tomorrow, but a little bit today, about what that means then. Now that Rome is long gone, not a power anymore, what does it mean? How does that call still come alive for us to come out of Babylon? And what does it mean to not participate in Rome and its political economy? Any responses on that? Questions? Comments? Where do you see Babylon today? If not in the universal product code here, the 666 symbol that's even on our religious books and Bibles. What does it mean to not be part of the system of domination? Uh-huh.
Just a question first, Barb. I'm wondering, obviously Rome wasn't destroyed. I mean, this is a symbolic enactment of I think it's saying, it's there, but don't give it any, it's destroyed for you. Don't give it any legitimacy and live differently. But I'm wondering how that image of coming out would play in relation to Jesus, to one of the groups that came out were the Essenes. I mean, they just said, you can't be God's people in the world, and so we come out and we create our own in the world. And they apparently were waiting for the violence of God to rectify everything. Now, Jesus seems very different than that and seems to say, no, don't come out of the world exactly. Come out of the domination system and live differently. Is that how you understand the meaning of come out in from John and Patmos?
Well, yeah. I mean, a lot is debated about that. It certainly couldn't be calling for a literal exodus. I mean, the Essenes actually left Jerusalem and went to the desert and lived down at Qumran. It's probably not calling for a literal kind of physical exodus like this, but it's an exodus. I mean, the word for come out is ex eltheta, ex like the exodus, come out, come on. And the word hodos is the word for way. So an ex hodos is the way out. I mean, it's calling for us in some way, metaphorically, spiritually, to come out, to go on a way, an exodus out of the Roman system. Yeah, and what it was, I mean, I think that's, it's debated. It wasn't calling for them to go to move somewhere else physically, probably. It wasn't calling them to leave Ephesus and leave the cities where they live, but it was calling for some kind of departure, as you're saying. And how that was understood, whether it meant don't use the coinage, don't eat meat, whatever. I mean, it was probably something every Christian had to struggle with. And the urgency is because, as we saw in the seven letters, not all the people in the churches saw the situation as sort of as urgent as John did. And I suppose that's our situation today as well. Pablo Richard talks about it as a, let's see if I can find this quote. I really love what he says about 18:4.
Well, it could be coming out like the Montanans, you know, that sequester themselves away in northern Idaho. And I mean, that could be the extreme interpretation.
Yeah, and I don't think that's what it's about. He talks about it as creating alternatives. Here it is. This is his interpretation. God's people must leave Rome. Well, no, I mean, they're living in Asia Minor. So obviously it's a leaving, not in a physical sense, but in a spiritual and political sense. God's people must leave Rome so as not to be in complicity with its sins. The departure from Rome is understood not in a physical sense, but is to be economic, social, political, and spiritual. The idea is to resist, to refuse to participate, to create alternatives. And that's what we'll talk about more about tomorrow. I mean, we've got to create alternatives to this so that people don't think this is the only possibility for God's rule. I mean, there's a different reality. That's what it's about, I think. I think it's more envisioning alternatives and then living in terms of those. But good question. I mean, that's what we all are called to discern together, I think. And Holden's a great place to start talking about. I mean, you've left something behind to come up here. You've already undertaken some sort of an exodus into the... into community here.
And then you have to return to it. That's the, that's sure. not just the escape.
But you can live differently.
Mm-hmm. Paul, the Pauline notion of being in the world and not part of the world, Luther's whole incarnational theology presupposes or pushes one to that notion of being in the world and discerning the reconciling, loving, redemptive acts of God, and one attaches oneself there and leaves the other as best one can.
Yeah, and all of these books are using the notion of citizenship. I mean, Paul talks about that too, that you're to see your true citizenship as being part of God's realm, and that that has to mean somehow not paying allegiance to Rome, even in a partial way. I mean, John is a sort of extremist. So whereas the Lutheran idea is sort of you can have the two realms and dual citizenship, I think John of Patmos would not think that you could have dual citizenship. You don't have two passports in his view. You have one, and you must not pay allegiance to Rome. Uh-huh.
You know, you've alluded to the juxtaposing Romans 13 and Revelation 13 and Paul's understanding of the relationship to Rome vis-a-vis what we see here later, I guess later on in the 90s.
Uh-huh.
And Romans was written much earlier than
yeah.
that. Do you see this as a way of, not to trying to gloss this whole thing over, but do you see this as a way to kind of harmonize those two writers' views of the relationship of Christian to government, to state, is through the business of creating alternative? Because Paul also had a higher allegiance than just to Rome. You work with that a little bit, you know, because you've alluded to these two texts being so different.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. I mean, some people can't even imagine that Paul wrote Romans 13, because in other points he also is so critical of the current political economy. Now, the latest has been a guy named Mark Nanos has written a book arguing that it's not Rome that's referred to at all in Romans 13. It's the Jewish authority. It's the synagogue authority. So obeying authorities means obey the synagogue, not obey Rome. Because he actually doesn't specify that it's government. He just says all government is created by God. And then, but it could be the government of the synagogue. I mean, he doesn't say it's the empire. So that's an intriguing idea. I think that... I think we've been more more in bed with government than most New Testament writers would permit. But certainly there's a diversity of viewpoints, and John of Patmos is way out there on the continuum. I mean, there's certainly a continuum. Where you put Paul is debatable as to what you think he's doing in Romans 13 and whether you think that was an anomaly or that's central to his theology or what. But I think even Paul at other points... I mean, he certainly knew what it was like to live under persecution. He himself was imprisoned by government. He knew how bad Rome could be in its worst moments. And then ultimately he was killed, I don't think Paul was as pro-government as we sometimes paint him. But there is a diversity of viewpoints in the New Testament.
Isn't part of the problem that we rely upon the book of Acts because I think the book of Acts really... gave us a very misleading picture of Paul's relationship with Rome.
Yeah.
It makes it sound like the Romans are constantly defending Paul.
And then all the blame is cast on the Jewish synagogue. Yeah, it's a transference of, yeah. I mean, it was a dilemma for early Christians, whether your job is to stay alive. I mean, everyone struggles with this. Dietrich Bonhoeffer really, you know, whether he would look at the Old Testament and say, you know, there's a sense in which you are supposed to be alive to have progeny, you know. And so if to stay alive, you've got to you know, go along in a way. I mean, this was a dilemma for people that we hardly can understand what it's like. But they all had an understanding, I would say, of the Roman system as, by and large, being an occupying power. Certainly the Gospels have, you know, I mean, it's very clear that in Palestine, Rome's occupation of Galilee and Palestine and Judea was harsh. But that was the only thing there was. I mean, so how do you resist when there's sort of no possibility of overthrowing it? What does resistance mean? That was the question then. All right, let's take a look at the millennium. Whoa, we got 5 minutes here to get to chapter 20 in the millennium. Sandwiched between the two visions of the two cities, Babylon and New Jerusalem, is this strange chapter 20. I would never give it any truck in a study of Revelation. I don't think it's a particularly central chapter, except that it is the year 2000, so we need to look at it because everyone else is. So we'll just take a look here. I think there's some very interesting stuff here in Revelation 20, and it does come as part of the exodus between the two cities here. From out of Babylon and into New Jerusalem comes this chapter. If I can get the screen up, otherwise you'll have to just imagine that behind us. Okay. In chapter 20, Satan goes the rest of the way down. He's thrown out of heaven onto earth in chapter 12, so things are intensifying and worsening in 13 and 17. Now in chapter 20, Satan gets tied up and bound and thrown down for 1,000 years. Then we've got this beautiful vision of the saints reigning with God. Verse 4, I saw thrones, and those seated on them were those to whom judgment was committed. And then people who have died come to life and reign with Christ 1,000 years. Verse 6 here, blessed and holy is the one who shares in the first resurrection. Over such, the second death has no power, but they shall be priests of God and of Christ and shall reign with Christ 1,000 years. I'm wearing my Millennium Countdown t-shirt here. We have 176 days, 14 hours, 8 minutes, 38 seconds till the millennium. What, if anything, does the year 2000 have to do with the book of Revelation? What I really want to say is nothing. If you're looking for the 2000th anniversary of Jesus' birth, it probably was 4 BC, or it probably was 1996 because we think Jesus was born in 4 BC. If you think the millennium started with the legitimization of Christianity when it became legal, then you would want to wait until about 2300 something, because that would be the 2000th anniversary of Constantine. Well, let me say further, this vision, you know, is not in our creeds. We in the Apostles and Nicene creeds, we say that we believe that Jesus is coming to get, again to judge the quick and the dead. But there's nothing about a 1,000-year reign. This is the only place in the New Testament that you find anything like this, of a millennial reign. It's a very sort of, it's a one-shot deal. This is the only place there's anything about it. Certainly we all believe in the second coming of Jesus, but the millennial reign, that is peculiar only to the book of Revelation. I think far too much has been made of it. It's not central to Christian theology, nor has it been. And if you want to hear more about that, go to Mark Wilhelm's sessions on the millennium and stuff. But it is part of the book of Revelation, and this is a study of Revelation, so what do we do with it? I want to suggest a couple things. First of all, this priesthood idea in verse 6. I think the millennium can be a really important time for Christians to recover this notion of all of us as priests, which is so strong in Revelation. You see it in chapter 1, chapter 5, and again here. What does it mean to be a priest? What are we as priests? You know, really think about your vocation as ministry and your priesthood. It's a strong focus in the book of Revelation, as it is in 1 Peter. And Martin Luther recovered this idea as part of the Reformation, the priesthood of all of us. That's why we don't call our pastors priests, but rather use the word shepherd or pastor, so that it's a reminder that everyone is a priest. When you were baptized, you were ordained as a priest. What does that mean? Think about that for the millennium. Second possibility for this chapter, Elizabeth Schisler Fiorenza argues that this is another one of those salvation interludes. Just like we saw between the sixth and seventh seal, you'll see between the sixth and seventh trumpet, this is an interlude. Only this one, it's a temporal sense of an interlude. It's a period of years that is meant then to be reassuring to all of us that we are those who are saved by God not to be scared of what the future will bring, but to know that we're part of, in our baptism, we've been adopted as priests, and we are those indeed who are spoken about in this vision. So it's salvation, it's not judgment. A third suggestion is what's made by Pablo Richard here, and I think this is a very intriguing one. He translates chapter 20, verse 4, not in a sense of judgment, but justice. And let me find it here. He translates it as follows. I saw thrones, and those who were seated on them were granted the power to do justice. You can do that in Greek. Judgment and justice, they're cognate enough, related words, that you can translate it this way. I mean, it's not, it wouldn't be the first translation I would think of, but I think it's a legitimate one. And in that sense then, since we're those who are seated on those thrones, it can become an opportunity to look at the millennium, he says, as a possibility to do justice. And what might that mean? And that's what some of the justice-oriented groups that you hear about now are picking up on. The millennium is, in a sense, a totally arbitrary date. When the cultural odometer on our calendar, you know, clicks over from all the nines line up and flip over to zeros, you probably know that it's not really the millennium anyway because of the missing year zero problem. You know, we really should wait another year. Well, no one's going to wait because it's like an odometer on your car. It's when the nines turn over to zeros. Something's happening in terms of our Christian calendar. So what is it? What do we do with it? It's a time to look ahead, to look back, to take stock. Some of the justice-oriented groups that I work with, like the Jubilee 2000 program, mm-hmm. are using this arbitrary occasion, and they admit it, to combine it with a text from Leviticus 25, the idea of the Jubilee and forgiving debts and stuff, to say, let's make this a year of debt forgiveness for some of the poorest nations in the world. It only comes around every 1,000 years. There's no problem. We're not setting a precedent, you know. So, you know, why don't we take this one-shot deal kind of chance to forgive some debt that people can't pay anyway? So that's one proposal. Arbitrary, of course, has nothing to do theologically with Revelation, but then, you know, I don't think the millennium has anything to do with the year 2000 exactly either. So see what you think of some of these proposals. Another one that I'm working on, is, since I work with Lutheran Peace Fellowship, is this appeal by the Nobel Peace Prize laureates to make the year 2000 a year of education for nonviolence and the first decade of the new millennium a decade for a culture of nonviolence. Again, just sort of stealing the date. But somebody's going to make something of this date. I mean, I think the church has a role in claiming the millennium, not for sort of commercialism or alarmism, I don't want Y2K to be the last word about the year 2000. I think it would be very sad. The church needs to proclaim a vision of hope and alternate visions of what can be done with this year. So if any of you want to pick these handouts up as you go out, that's fine. You know, certainly these are just options for what we can do with this date, but I think it does mean something. Few have ever lived to see this kind of turnover on the calendar. Let's do something with it. You know, really think about what it means that at least that our calendar is set up to be a Christian calendar, and there's going to be a kind of important changeover of dates coming up. What, if anything, does it have to do with Revelation 20 and this millennium vision, and what can we do that's a real Christian response to the millennium? I think it's a fascinating question. Let's just have a few minutes for discussion here. When the bell rings, then, you know, feel free to go up to coffee break and let the discussion continue. I'd love to hear what, if any, of you have planned for the millennium, what you're thinking about this date.
Everything here is talking about the millennium being 1,000 years. Where's the 2,000?
I know, nowhere. It's just that we missed the first 1,000. There's nothing. We missed the first one. There was a lot of panic in the year 1,000, although they didn't have as many calendars as we do. And then others argued that it should be the year 1,300, you know. So they, but yeah, there was much more going on then than we need to do now. But, you know, the companies have figured out. I saw a headline in the New York Times business section a year and a half ago saying, forget Armageddon, think commercial potential. And the millennium is a great marketing theme. I mean, that's why so much is being made of it. It's marketing. And it's really a good, you know, I mean, look at this T-shirt company. How much money are they making? Who knows? Lots. There was an ad in the United Airlines Flight magazine in April for a Millennium Magnum Cognac carafe that costs $48,000. And people are actually going to buy this cognac carafe. I mean, there's lots of money being made with the millennium. So what is a Christian response? How do we counter that with something that the church is going to say or do about the millennium? Any of you know what you're going to do for the millennium? You got any plans? Going to stay awake?
There was a group at our church who are going to gather and stay overnight. One of the members of our church is Don Knuth, who's this great guru in computer science. And he's semi-frightened enough that he doesn't want to be anywhere near airplanes or anywhere outside of being on the ground in a safe place. And he's got this group of people, and he's not an alarmist by any means, but so there's a cadre of 10, 15 people that are going to stay at church and be available for if anyone has any problems in their home or with their car or their anything like that. So that's what they've been pondering.
I think it's an opportunity. I'm an emergency nurse, and it's an opportunity for people that are a little bit on the edge sometimes to step over. It's like full moons, and there's really no scientific research that validates that full moons brings, wildness out. But it's like New Year's Eve. It's an opportunity, 4th of July with fireworks, for people to have an excuse for abuse. I hate to sound negative, but it pushes people over the edge.
Are you working that night? Do you know yet?
I don't know.
It's a Friday, just to let you know, it's a Friday night. So if you want to be at church on a Friday night, that's a good place to be. I mean, churches did used to have New Year's Eve services. In my internship church, we had that. I mean, it might be something to think about. It's only once every 1,000 years, so you're not setting a precedent. Those of you who are pastors or whatever, you won't have to do it every year, just this once. You can.
Is it a full moon, too?
I don't know. I have no idea. Actually, we're going to have a retreat up here at Holden Village if you want to come up here with Lutheran Peace Fellowship, looking at some of these, actually doing some nonviolence training, how to start this year of education for nonviolence. If you want to be completely off the grid, nowhere further.
I'm going to have to worry about electricity too much up here, probably.
About what?
The electricity.
No, we have our own little hydroelectric plant, and I'm sure the generators were created before there were any computers or anything. So we have much older machinery up here that predates computers.
Yeah, that's good.
All right, well, I need to let you go. So let the conversation continue. Tomorrow there will be a lot more time for discussion as we talk about the New Jerusalem vision and how this is a vision of the alternative that we're called to live in terms of, and how we can do that in our congregations, what it means to come out and then participate as citizens of a different realm. Thanks.